Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our guest today is Mark Pilkington. Mark is a longtime friend of me, and he is finally a person who has been able to get into print what I hoped he would have done or have been able to do for quite a number of years. And the baby which has been born is a book called Mirage Men. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello, Philip.
So, for people who don't know who you are, because you are definitely far better known in the UK than in America, what's your trajectory and what is Mirage Men all about? Because really, Mirage Men, to me, is about a new way of exploring the UFO phenomenon in a way which nobody has ever done, and coming to conclusions and insights into the people populating the UFO field and the UFO subject, which is really innovative and really kind of like, you know, something which is so refreshing that I think everybody should already have read the book rather than should read the book now.
Well, I hope some of them will have read it and others will read it soon. But yeah, I'm a writer predominantly, and we met over 10 years ago, I think, when I was working at 40 and Times magazine, which has been running itself for over 30 years now and is certainly the UK's kind of predominant journal of strange phenomena, and I still think the best magazine in the world for people interested in the anomalous, although there are also many other great magazines, of course. But and I've been, all my life, I've been fascinated with the paranormal, supernatural, parapsychology, magic, and all of those strange things that don't quite fit into the ordinary model of everyday life. But one of the things that particularly fascinated me and from my childhood was the UFO story, which is, I think, is the classic modern manifestation of the anomalous and of the sort of magical in our modern technological society. And so with Mirage Men, after a lifetime's fascination, I finally sort of dove in properly and tried to make sense of a story that really doesn't want sense to be made of it. And this was done with my friend and crop circle making colleague John Lundberg. So for over 6 years we worked on the project, and we were actually shooting a documentary film at the same time, which as yet still hasn't been edited together, but we hope one day it will. And the book is really partly, it's sort of a three-part book, I think. Partly it's the story of our own exploration of this field, of the UFO field, and of some of the kind of figures who really drive the subject in many ways, and drive the culture, and kind of introduce the new ideas and themes that make their way into the popular ufological discourse. Partly it's a historical overview of the subject, with a specific reference to the involvement of the American intelligence and military intelligence services, and the ways in which they have, rather than covering up the truth about aliens and crashed flying saucers and strange agreements and contracts between a secret government cabal and an extraterrestrial race, rather than covering up these stories, they've actually been in some ways generating them and promoting them as a cover for their own more mundane operations. And on a third level, I think it's a book about the nature of belief and how it feels to experience the extraordinary and to be party to extraordinary ideas and beliefs.
It's a very multi-leveled approach, and what I when we look into modern day America, if not modern day the world, the headlines in America right now are about how 50% of Americans believe 50% of Republicans believe Obama is born in Kenya, which is a clear and fabricated lie. Yet people believe and endorse this because somehow those people have a need for that kind of belief. So, when you're talking about this need to believe in a conspiracy by the government, and you begin to explore this when it comes to ET and UFO, what I loved about your approach and your findings, which you kind of like etched throughout the book, is that you have people within the government who either do or are paid to lie about the UFO phenomenon, not by saying no, it doesn't exist, but actually by creating stories like the MJ-12 papers. And in a few seconds, if you could just explain to us what the MJ-12 papers are. But then you find, rather than the belief that you would think these are people you're going to hate and people who are just plain evil and kind of like are there to completely fool the country and the world, you actually find that these people believe that there is an ET out there and or that they might be in contact with the government. So it's like this, there's a classic line in V from Vendetta that artists use lies to tell the truth. And so I guess the overall question is the people involved with this, and I'm sure you're going to mention name in a few minutes, are they artists to get the truth out, or are they really straightforward liars? And I think that's a very interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, and that's a great line from the great Alan Moore. Yes, I mean it's also that also is a perfect parallel with the work that John and I and others do, making crop circles. And in that instance, we really consider our work to be art, and to be a sort of artistic work. But yes, I mean, this was one of the great puzzles for us, and I don't think it can be answered in a sort of black and white fashion. And that's one of the sort of important points I eventually end up making in the book, is that there are very few straightforward answers when you enter this saucer-shaped hall of mirrors. Mythologically, it's interesting because at the end I talk a little bit in the book about trickster mythologies, and one of the things that the trickster does. So, for example, in North American Indian cultures, they'd be often portrayed as a coyote, and this becomes a wily coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons. But the coyote is always setting traps and actually introduces technology to humankind in the form of fish traps and nets and things. But one of the things that happens to the coyote is he's constantly getting caught in his own traps. And I think what we've found in the sort of UFO community and with the Mirage Men, as I call them, is that the sort of deception has been too successful. It's been so successful that now many people within the military and intelligence arenas have actually fallen into the trap that was prepared by their predecessors in the same organizations. And I think this goes back to the very early days of the UFO story, as far back as 1947, when generally it's considered Kenneth Arnold's sighting of flying objects over Washington State sort of kick-started the modern UFO flying saucer era. And I think from the word go, the intelligence agencies, particularly in the Air Force, were involved in manufacturing deceptions and exploiting beliefs in extraterrestrial visitors and flying saucers. And now, 50, 60 years down the line, those beliefs are so deeply ingrained within the general public, but also within the political and military establishments, that they're impossible to erase. And you'll find There are people in America, there are people at high levels of government in the White House, in the military, in all areas of life, in the media, in Hollywood, and in the entertainment business. This is really now a sort of matter of belief. It's a modern sort of religion, really. It has its own codes and creed. And I think as a result, because of this, I think the people who have these beliefs should be treated with as much respect as those who believe in any other religion. And I think that's very important. So when you come to realize that this is about faith and it's about something that isn't as straightforward as a kind of, it's not a clockwork puzzle, it's something deeper and more profound and more spiritual, then it becomes easier to understand why these beliefs are so unshakable and so strongly held by so many people.
And what has become the Bible of the last 20 years or so is this document called the MJ-12 Papers. Can you just kind of like give us a bit more detail into what it is, but also your findings about it?
Yeah, well, the MJ-12 Papers appeared, first of all, on a roll of film placed through the letterbox of a TV and film producer called Jamie Chanderer. I believe he was in Los Angeles at the time, in 1984. And what they purported to be was a series of documents outlining a special program put into place by President Truman in 1947 to sort of set up a cabal, if you like, a sort of secret organization within the U.S. military and government to oversee the relationship between the sort of leaders of the American political and military establishment and scientific establishment and any extraterrestrial beings or visitors that we might have. And this was allegedly sort of kick-started by the Roswell crash in July 1947. Which is perhaps the most famous UFO incident in history, when an alien spacecraft is said to have crash-landed in Roswell, New Mexico. And the MJ-12 papers were initially kind of a covering letter introducing the idea, then a list of the 12 members of the organization, and there were also other clues kind of scattered around the place that Chanderer and his colleague William Moore, who had co-written the first major book on the Roswell incident, called The Roswell Incident, in 1980, they sort of began to collate this information. And actually, because they were careful researchers, rather than immediately release it to the world, they sat on this information and started doing their own research. It's a very complex story because Moore had at the same time been cooperating with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, which is their own kind of internal FBI that's involved with counterintelligence and protecting the security of Air Force bases and Air Force technology. And he'd actually been working with people from this organization, from this department, helping them to understand the sort of popular prevailing themes within contemporary UFO research, and most controversially of all, then passing disinformation, so that's information that appears to be truthful or appears to be accurate, back into the UFO culture. So this was in the form of occasional documents and ideas. Now, what's interesting with the MJ-12 papers is while William Moore and Jamie Chanderer kept a lid on them, whoever was disseminating the papers was very keen to get them out into the world. So actually, they passed them when it became clear that they weren't going to be made public immediately in America, then they were handed to British researchers, one of whom declined to do anything with them, and another, Timothy Good, published them as an appendix to his book Above Top Secret that was published in 1986 and became a huge runaway bestseller. And when this happened, Moore and Shandera realized that they just Good had jumped the gun and that they needed to get the story out there. So before long, these papers became the talk of the ufological community, because what they purported to show is what by this time the UFO community itself believed to be the truth, that there'd been a 40-year cover-up of the fact that the American military and the American government had knowledge of extraterrestrial visitation on planet Earth dating back to at least 1947, and if, depending on which versions of the story you believe, may even have had relations with live extraterrestrial beings and have exchanged technology with this with these beings. So this was really, this was the crown jewels. This was the smoking gun, or whatever other metaphor you want to use. This was exactly what they'd been waiting for. But it became quite. They were obviously controversial very early on, and I and many others would argue that the papers are far too good to be true, and it would take another hour to explain all the intricacies of why they are almost certainly fabricated. But it's enough perhaps to say that in the late 80s, when an FBI trainee recruit at at the FBI's training academy was found in possession of these papers, which are marked top secret, the FBI themselves instigated an investigation to find out whether or not their recruit was in possession of what would be illegal documents. And they searched high and low. They asked whether this was Russian disinformation. They asked whether it was American disinformation, whether it was a hoax put out by the UFO community, and they couldn't find anyone to give them any information until very quietly the Air Force Office of Special Investigations sent them a letter stating that they couldn't really talk about it in any detail, but that the papers were bogus. And there's actually a great in the FBI's of publicly released files, there's a great copy of the MJ-12 papers with the word bogus written in big letters across the front, and I think that's as satisfying a conclusion as you'll find. But there's still no there's no clarity as to exactly who made the papers or why, but per my own suspicion that I present in the book and suspicion of others, I'm certainly not the only one to believe this, is that they were really created as a kind of bait, a lure, to test out various people in the UFO field and to help promote ideas of extraterrestrial contact. And my own personal belief, based on my research, and I don't have any, there's plenty of circumstantial evidence for this, but I don't have a smoking gun, but my own personal suspicion is that this was all about the stealth aircraft program, which was basically in its first wave of development in the period we're talking about, so from the late 70s through to the early 1980s. And other people have hinted to me, although again I don't have official sort of documentation for it, that there was a concern that the Soviets, the KGB, were using UFO researchers in America to find out about the stealth program for them, by getting them to believe that what they were researching was UFO information, but in fact was actually helping the Russians to learn more about the stealth program. But I hope one day the truth of this, of whether or not that's the case, will emerge. But that's the sort of working hypothesis at the moment. But what's fascinating about the MJ-12 papers is, yes, 30 years later, they're still really a kind of a holy text for many in the UFO community, particularly worldwide now. And there are apocryphal chapters. There are new documents still being produced and disseminated over the internet and published in books and magazines to this day. So they're really a growth industry in themselves, and I like to think of them as sort of a real-life sort of role-playing game scenario that's sort of being extended out into the world over many years.
Well, one of the things I think one of the more interesting aspects of the MJ-12 papers is also the context in which they were done, because the entire Paul Benowitz affair is something which I've always taken great interest in, and how William Moore has kind of become the Judas, and the Gospel of Judas, i.e. the Gospel of William Moore, really has become lost, because here we have an investigation of, and if you allow me, I'll just quickly do it myself, Mark.
Yeah.
Which you know, we have a UFO researcher who is picking up secret transmissions from an airfield nearby, military airfield nearby. He mentions this to various people. They find out that this UFO researcher, even though he claims he thinks he's picking up alien communications, it's actually not true. He's actually picking up secret cables. They begin to spin a story. They begin to give him specific disinformation. And one of the people involved is William Moore, one of the principal UFO researchers, a person who wrote together with Charles Berlitz a number of books. Within that group, you then have the entire MJ-12 papers coming out. And when William Moore is about to be exposed and or chooses to go public with his role in what has been happening to Benowitz, he confesses in front of hundreds of people at a major UFO conference, now more than 20 years ago, retires from the field, but also his name has been completely forgotten. In the sense that he doesn't get mentioned, he's not given a central role anymore, because if you reinsert the role of William Moore into this saga, you get a radically different image. And it's almost like, yeah. What Kathleen's readers will know, is like once you reinsert the role of Mary Magdalene back into Christianity, you get a completely radical view of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So we have this field of ufology who keeps denying almost the existence of one of their most principal researchers, who basically said, "I spread disinformation."
Yes, and it's no surprise to discover that, other than senior, very senior active Air Force people that we approached, William Moore was the only person that we couldn't talk to, and we tried for 6 years to talk to him, and he just wasn't interested. He said he'd retired from the field. And he's a very, I think he's a very smart person. I think he's a very complex person. And from everything I've, you know, been told by people who knew him, his motivations were for the most part in good faith, in that he thought that if he played the Air Force's game and sort of, you know, worked as a kind of middleman in their disinformation scheme, that he would actually be the favor would be returned, and he'd be given the information that he really believed was out there. And when the MJ-12 documents turned up, different people have different ideas about this, but I suspect he initially thought that they were the real deal. And you know, again, from other people who knew him, like my friend Greg Bishop, who played a big role in our research and in the book. You know, Greg has no doubt that Bill Moore really did believe that that the U.S. government were hiding this apocalyptic truth, in the old sense, this revelatory truth that would change reality for everybody on the planet. And it's a shame that we couldn't speak to him to find out how he feels about it now. He's based in Los Angeles as well, so perhaps you can track him down. But
we will drag him in front of our microphone.
Yeah, but he. I mean, the thing with, you know, I think the thing with Moore is he, you know, he got in very deep. He did. I'm sure he felt very uncomfortable about some of the things he was asked to do, like passing what he knew to be false documentation to Paul Benowitz, and the fact that Paul Benowitz, as a result of this operation conducted against him by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, did eventually have a very serious and dramatic breakdown. It was too much for him. So, you know, I have no doubt that this is probably not a part of his life that he's sort of happy to revisit, and understandably. And as, you know, as I think a lot of people learn, that you know, if you can get burned when you, you know, when you get too close to this kind of sort of dangerous, ontologically dangerous material. I think it can just get out of hand quite quickly. And that's one of the things that what was very interesting for John Lundberg and I doing our own investigation is that, you know, there was constantly this, as we met these people who, you know, had been inside the military or the intelligence machinery for so many years, and finding people who, despite knowing of the kinds of disinformation and deception that went on, still had really firm beliefs in the reality of extraterrestrial visitation, this obviously started to color our own perception. And one of my favorite kind of episodes in the book is when John actually began to, despite having made crop circles for 15 years and generally being a skeptic in this in the classical sense, he really did begin to believe that the cover-up was real and that the extraterrestrials were here and were out there. And actually, this was hugely troubling to him and caused him a lot of personal difficulties and trouble. And again, Greg Bishop and I had to sort of talk him down over a couple of beers and try to get him to sort of rather than straighten out his thinking, return some flexibility to his thinking. I think that's really the secret to surviving in this kind of domain, in this arena gray area of sort of beliefs and deceptions and possibilities, is you have to keep a very flexible mind. If you get too rigid in your thinking, then you can snap very easily, and that, I think that's certainly what happens to a lot of people in the UFO community, and I'm sure in Kathleen's community as well.
Well, I think one of the reasons about religion is always that you choose to become a fundamentalist because you know that certain things of the Bible are not real, that they have been altered, but that, you know, you will dig into it no matter what. And I think some of that is the UFO material as well. But when we go back to the early days of UFO research, there are very interesting, real metaphysical layers. Alan Dulles, the person who created the CIA, the person who, Leon Davidson, one of the early UFO researchers, who said that there was such a thing as a CIA disinformation campaign. And he identified Dulles as one of the key players, obviously because of his importance with the CIA. Yep. Dulles was extremely good friends with Carl Gustav Jung, who was, who wrote a book, I think, in 58 or 59 about UFOs, in which he said UFOs are real and they're gonna push us into the age of Aquarius. Either we change our ways or this phenomenon, this archetype, will do it for us. You write about Bernard Newman, and I'll let you expand a bit about what he believed and what he was doing. So that how should I put this? There seems to be a lie out there, but at the same time, there seems to be an underlying truth, and that truth mm-hmm. seems to be larger than reality itself, almost, which is kind yeah. of where you, John Rob Dickinson, who was the first person who introduced me to this when it comes to crop circles, you guys are not out there making crop circles to deceive people. You are not, how should I put this? You know, you're trying to manipulate whatever. You are convinced of what you do, and you're adding to this body of this foundation, really, of mm-hmm. this change. So, how does this all work?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a kind of phrase that would be handy is this idea of the sort of useful fiction, in that you know, if we look at the crop circles, I don't make them anymore, but the crop circles function as triggers, and you know, we would always say the real magic, and there is real magic in crop circles and in UFOs and in any transformative icons or images or objects. The real magic is in the relationship between the person who perceives or receives or communicates with that idea and then the rest of the world. It's not the creation of the event, it's the reception, really, of the image or the event that is magical. And I think I think that's really what Jung was talking about. I don't think that he literally believed that physical flesh and blood extraterrestrials were visiting the planet, but he understood incredibly well, and his book, for anybody who hasn't read it, I think is still one of the most important books on the subject. In his book, he's basically talking about how the idea itself is so potent that it could affect transformation, and that's, you know, that's again the same with any religious or spiritual system or crop circles, UFOs, whatever. It's the transformative effect and the impact that these things have on the world that is their real power. And that's what Dulles understood, and through his, I'm sure, through his friendship with Jung, and they were very close. I'm sure they would have had some interesting conversations on this subject. And one thing, you mentioned Bernard Newman, and he was a British thriller writer, former intelligence agent himself, who wrote the first Flying Saucer book, called The Flying Saucer, published in 1958, in which he presents the notion of an international group of scientists who stage flying saucer crashes around the world in order to create a kind of common enemy and unify the nations under the kind of common umbrella of humanity. And this was based on a speech that the British Foreign Minister Anthony Eden had made the year before at the UN, and which Ronald Reagan would make 40 years later in 1987, again at the UN, so saying that if we could be united in a common cause, even if that cause is an alien presence that may or may not be benevolent, then you know, we should encourage this belief. And I think one possibility, and this is just something I raise as a possibility in the book, and I think is a more abstract idea, but you can gives you a sense of the kind of thinking that may have prevailed in post-war America, where and the world in which the UFO sort of first took flight, is that after World War II, which was only equaled in horror by World War I, but which ended with the cataclysmic detonations over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what people saw there was a world in which the war was not ended by God or by morale or any particular moral code. The war was ended really by technology, and I think you could imagine a fear that the sort of potent role of science in everyday life was gradually going to erode people's belief in traditional spiritual or religious values, and also perhaps speed up the kind of loss of direction of the sort of the Christian moral compass. There was a need to find a new system or a new religion, and perhaps having kind of technological angels, having these long-haired, beautiful, blonde beings descending in glowing chariots from the stars and telling us how to live our lives and how to save the planet. The classic, the sort of archetypal case being Klaatu and the day the Earth stood still. Perhaps these sort of messengers from another world could actually take on the role of angels, of messengers, could actually be a new sort of conduit to a higher understanding and a higher consciousness and a higher level of morality, and perhaps kind of prevent a descent into darkness and cold technological chaos, which must have been a distinct possibility on people's minds after World War II. So I wonder if those are the kinds of conversations that Alan Dulles and Carl Jung might have been having. And certainly there's no doubt that the CIA and other organizations at the time did have certainly an interest in monitoring alleged contacts between humans and extraterrestrials. For example, the contactees like Daniel Fry, Howard Menger, and George Adamski. It might be the case that they were also actively engaged in creating these kinds of scenarios. And there's a very interesting paper that was published in 1950 by the RAND Corporation, which at the time was directly connected to the Air Force, in which they summarize the ways in which folklore and superstition might be deployed and weaponized as part of a sort of psychological warfare arsenal. And what's very interesting is that this was 1950, when RAND itself was very much was sort of becoming involved in the Flying Saucer program for the Air Force, doing a lot of collating of information and data. And the Flying Saucer story by this time was huge across the country. And yet in this 15-20-page document, there's not one mention of flying saucers, while almost every other kind of folkloric or superstitious sort of entity is brought up. Flying saucers are not mentioned anywhere. And I was just thinking the other day, actually, how one of the recommendations of this paper is that the sort of psychological warfare operators research and come to understand the beliefs and the hopes and the fears of the people that they wish to target. And I think you know, that kind of research, you can imagine, was going on perhaps around the flying saucer subject, where you have, for example, the perhaps with the contactees, tales of crash discs that were being that were already starting to be disseminated amongst the UFO community at the time. And you also get cases of Air Force people actually quizzing witnesses about what they saw and collating data. And perhaps this was the kind of research that that the Air Force were engaged in order to better understand people's beliefs about flying saucers. So I think there's a sort of real matrix of possibilities anyway that's sort of emerging out of into this sort of new world that was emerging in the post-war society.
Absolutely, and I kind of going slightly back to the Dulles-Jung era. One of the thoughts I've always had is this: like a very religious world, which it still is, but a very non-spiritual world, which largely this world still is, had lost this kind of close connection to the gods. Folklore, apart from certain parts of certain countries, has really died out. The little folklore which is happening today is more academic than anything else. It's derided by most people. And when you kind of like realize when you have two of the greatest minds, Dulles maybe for the wrong reasons, but nevertheless an extremely intelligent person, talking to Carl Gustav Jung about this in Switzerland during the war, and you see this happening, and you are, you know, in the case of Dulles, the most pivotal man in this worldview. The question I always had is like, okay, did Jung somehow say, okay, we got here to this point? Because we are losing archetypes, we're losing the power to really feel closely connected to something supernatural. We are so far away from experiencing something. And kind of like, you know, did the story of UFOs, is it really a lie? But is it a lie to help us connect again to real archetypes, to real belief into something and experiencing something? Because the classic paradigm is always like, oh, well, if UFOs were real, they would land on the White House. But the thing is that, you know, UFOs, whatever they are, and there are far too many, so to speak, to be completely fabricated. There is a genuine UFO phenomenon there. Is that something to really empower people, literally in the fields and at their home, into making the realization that there is something more out there? And is it just a sign of our times that we are calling it ET rather than ultra-terrestrial or otherworldly or whatever yeah. semantics you want to use it?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you that I do believe there's a genuine phenomenon, or more likely a series of phenomena that get kind of grouped together under this one umbrella. And I think there is, you know, the more we understand the universe around us and the world around us through our own sort of scientific research and scientific methodology, the greater the shadows will become. And you know, I think the taller the towers of science get, the longer the shadow they cast. And I don't think you can really we'll never eradicate that need for both a mystery and a connection with something greater. And I think that urge, that drive, whatever you want to call it, that need, will always find ways to manifest that are most appropriate to the culture in which we exist. And I think one of the great other, you know, really great books of the past decade or couple of decades that talks generally about anomalous phenomena and anomalous culture is The Trickster and the Paranormal by George Hansen. And in that, he basically suggests that this kind of trickster archetype, which manifests so clearly through all manner of paranormal and anomalous events and experiences, is just a critical part of, it's a critical a part of the human condition and of human culture. And it's the thing that's constantly creating new questions, creating mysteries, and it's these mysteries and questions that drive us onwards and sort of push us forwards. And there's no doubt, I mean, there people in sort of neuroscience now talk about sort of, you know, that God or religious belief is hardwired into the brain for whatever reason. So I think, you know, there are those of us who are always going to be seeking something more or looking for something more in the world, and it might be UFOs and extraterrestrials for some of us, and it might be grail mysteries for some of us, and it might be crop circles for some of us, and it might be esoteric Christianity for others. But, you know, there's whatever flavor you choose to draw upon, there will be something there for you. And I think the incredible diversity and just depth of beliefs that exist in our world now is a real sort of testament to our ability to imagine and to search for meaning. So yes, but I think, and one of the great, again coming back to this 1950 Rand paper about psychological warfare and superstition is that it, again, it advises people to sort of seek out what the prevailing beliefs of a region that you're working in are. But one of the great things, I think, about the UFO, one of the things that makes it such a perfect tool or vessel for psychological warfare, is that it is now, in the 21st century, it's a universally recognizable, iconic form. You know, the flying saucer or the flying triangle, which, again, you know, very archetypal, classical, geometric forms, the circle and the triangle, are instantly recognizable and are seen and described in every corner of the world now. And it took time for that kind of dissemination to take place, but it has done. And I think it'd be interesting to sort of chart the spread of the sort of American popular cultural diaspora alongside the spread of beliefs in UFOs and extraterrestrial visitors. I think the two are closely connected, but of course every culture also has its sort of unseen occupants, its spirit beings or other little people or shadow people or animals or, you know, those things that connect the human and the other worlds. But the UFOs are a kind of technological variant of this ancient and very human condition, I think.
You know, I see that the rise, particularly in America, of fundamental Christianity, all dogmatic religion, in my point of view, has robbed us of our mysticism. And mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the recurring and sort of resurging fascination in UFO phenomenon, extraterrestrial activity, is in part a response to this. I think what's happening, certainly what I'm seeing in the communities that I work in terms of spirituality and literature, people are really, really searching. They really want to know that there is something bigger and better and greater out there that we are connected to. And I think that a lot of them have been stymied by the boxes they've been put in terms of religion. You know, mm-hmm. that their own personal mysticism as humans has been somewhat taken away from them, or at least suppressed. And I think that there is a means for them in exploring this extraterrestrial phenomenon that takes them sort of back to something that feels greater and feels mystical.
Yes, absolutely. And it's something you can... And what, another great thing about the UFO phenomenon as an expression of human to mystical being is how democratic it is. And it's just a matter of, and I know this from when I was very, you know, was deeply involved in sort of the UFO world in my youth. You know, you could just stand outside at night and gaze at the stars, and you could almost feel the potential, the possibility twinkling above your head, and you know, any glimpse of light that you saw would give you a sudden. Surge of optimism and hope, and the sense that, you know, that something could be out there. And I think fundamentally, not to sound reductionist, but we all want to be saved. We all want to be protected by someone or something, and we want something that is smarter than us, that is more knowledgeable than us, that is more experienced than us, to guide us and to save us from the darkness and ultimately from ourselves. And I think once it became clear for many people that the sort of traditional notions of a sort of patriarchal God weren't going to do that, then other alternatives began to spring up, until you have now this sort of incredibly rich multiplicity of possibility. But the UFO is what, the other thing that makes it so powerful is that it's an incredibly plausible sort of vehicle for these kinds of ideas. There's, to me, I'd be and to many people who are professionally engaged with studying the heavens and studying the cosmos, it seems more incredible to imagine that there is no other life that we could recognize as similar to ourselves out there in the universe than that it is. I mean, it's just the distances involved obviously make it unlikely that that we'll be sort of meeting them anytime soon. But and I don't personally believe that any of the encounters or stories or tales that are told within the UFO lore actually represent genuine encounters with advanced technological non-human societies. However, that doesn't mean they haven't been here and quite likely evaded our notice. And I think if they were smart, they would have done. But yeah, the potential is certainly there, and that's one of the things that sort of gives it such great mythic and mystical potency, I think.
You recently curated an event called The Abuses of Enchantment, which I thought was really fascinating, and I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about that, about how that came about and where you were going with that idea.
Yeah, so the Abuses of Enchantment was it's actually a talk that I've been giving to various groups, often actually interestingly artists and art organizations, but it's talking about the ways in which psychological warfare practices can exploit beliefs in folkloric and supernatural entities or ideas. One short extract from an interview with villagers in Afghanistan conducted by a reporter for Pakistan's The Nation newspaper last April, I think this really sums up everything I talk about in Mirage Men and really sums up this idea of the abuses of enchantment. So this is a reporter talking to villagers about predator drones that have been carrying out sort of remote-controlled attacks, suspected terrorists or certainly enemy fighters in Afghanistan. And the villagers say, the drones are not material creatures, they are spiritual beings, and they live in outer space. And when they feel hungry, they swoop down and kill innocent women and children. They eat their corpses and fly back to their spatial residences for a siesta in their bedrooms in space. And it's been going on and on like this for years. So I think that just gives you an incredibly vivid sort of idea of the impact that advanced technologies and sort of devastating technologies can have on untechnologized communities, and that's really again the power of that's about the this idea of the abuse of enchantment, and also the way in which technologies become mythologized and how the sort of UFO story or the kind of greater idea of the UFO has even sort of transmogrified into these spiritual beings that are attacking women and children in Afghanistan. But in the Abuse of Enchantment talk and some of the materials taken from Mirage Men, I show how psychological warfare operators have exploited beliefs in the Philippines in a flying vampire called the Aswang, and in the 50s Colonel Edward Lansdale, a CIA, an Air Force intelligence officer who then worked for the CIA countering the communist guerrillas in the Philippines, he exploited beliefs in this Aswang, this vampire, by kidnapping a communist guerrilla and draining him of blood and then leaving him out on the patrol trail so that his colleagues, so that his sort of comrades found him and therefore believed that there was an Aswang in the area and they fled the area. That's one great example. And another would be the Wandering Soul, which was a tape recording used in the Vietnam War by the American Army's Psychological Operations Unit. And that was a tape recording made of a young Vietnamese girl talking to her father who'd been killed fighting the Americans, and in Vietnamese culture, if you're not buried in your home village, or certainly in the 960s, and the belief was that if you weren't buried in your village, then your soul would wander eternally and would never find peace. So you have a tape recording of a little girl talking to her, to the ghost of her father, who's complaining that he can't find his way home and that he misses his family. And this whole thing is recorded with lots of tape echo and heavy reverberations, and with Vietnamese traditional funeral music playing in the background. And they would place these tape recorders on the backs of soldiers walking through the jungle and play these at night to terrify the Vietnamese. And they'd also place them on helicopters, Apocalypse Now style, and play them at night to broadcast from the air. And the idea was to just spread the fear that was that even after death, if you took on the American forces after death, you would be a wandering soul and never find peace in the afterlife. So those are just some of the examples. But I think the short piece from Afghanistan really kind of brings that right up to date, and really, I think, brings the whole, everything I'm talking about in Mirage Men really brings it home and brings it to life.
And it has also brought us to the end of the show. Mark, thank you for your wonderful insights into the UFO phenomenon and so much more. We're definitely looking forward to a sequel to Mirage Men, so hurry up with doing that one. And actually also to see all of these people who you interviewed on your path appear either on the small TV screen or the big screen in your documentary together with John Lundberg. We mm-hmm. are the Spirit Revolution. You can listen to this recording on the BBS Radio Archive, which is on bbsradio.com. We are also on iTunes, and you can also go to our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com, where you will find the 5 latest episodes of our show online. Mark, thank you once again for being with us, and until the next time.
We're going to put up Mark's information on our website, so you'll have the links to take a closer look at his book, Mirage Men. For American listeners, you guys say mirage, but we say mirage, so I want to make sure they get the title. And until next time, the truth against the world.